From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. In case you hadn't noticed, flu season is fully upon us right now at its peak across the country, slamming households, schools, workplaces. It's slammed us. Maybe it slammed you. What makes a tough flu season? What about that flu shot? And where's the exit? This hour, On Point, the mysteries of the flu and who and how it's hitting right now. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Has it been a fierce flu season in your neck of the woods? Has it cleaned out your workplace? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. You can hear the reports from all over. Here's Stacy White, a mom in Tulsa, Oklahoma, suburb of Jinx, telling KJRH television last month the illness has hit everybody in her family, including her husband, her children.
This year has been... it seems like everybody's sick in some rotation. It's either my husband or me or our daughter or one of the boys.
Somebody, always somebody. Shane Johnson here at the Ray County School District in Tennessee, talking with NBC News last month, said the district closed for a few days because more than 700 students and teachers were sick.
So many teachers were sick, we were running out of substitutes that we could call on to use as well. So it's hit our community pretty hard.
Farmersburg, Indiana, late January, about 28% of the student population was out. Superintendent Mark Baker told WTWO television that that led him to cancel classes.
This is my 32nd year in education, and all the schools I've been a part of, we've never had to shut down a building because of the flu.
Has it hit you, your family, your workplace? Later this hour, we'll discuss a new study from the American Cancer Society showing a rise in colorectal cancer in young adults in their 20s and 30s. The first, influenza, the flu. Joining me now from Nashville, Tennessee, is Dr. William Schaffner, professor of preventative medicine in the Department of Health Policy at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. He's also a professor of medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases. Dr. Schaffner, Bill Schaffner, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you.
Where are we in the arc of this awful thing? Last week it dropped me like a stone. Where are we in the season?
Well, we're right in the peak of influenza season. Influenza likes to peak most often in February, and we're still right in the middle of it. There's flu all over the country. It's in your neighborhood, wherever you're listening.
What about the flu shot? Lots of people get it these days, and yet the flu just comes and comes. So how's it work, or how does it not work?
Well, if you expect perfection, I'm afraid you're going to be disappointed. The influenza vaccine is a good but not perfect vaccine. It prevents many, many cases of flu. And even when it doesn't prevent the flu completely, it actually has a tendency to prevent the dreaded complications of flu, pneumonia, hospitalization, and dying. As I like to tell my patients, if you're here complaining that you had the flu despite receiving the vaccine, mm-hmm. I said it's wonderful that you're here complaining.
Yes, yes. Upright and able to protest. Now, when I did finally go in, they put a swab up my nose and said, yeah, you got the flu. And they said that the flu shot this year was something like, I think, 40% effective. Is that right? And is that a good performance, a bad performance? Is it different every year?
Well, the overall interim mid-season evaluation shows that all ages, all comers, all different flu strains, it's about 48% effective. And that's right in the range that we usually expect. It works better in people who are younger and healthier, not quite as well in older people. And a very important point, we now have a couple of vaccines that are licensed for people age 65 and older, and they do provide better protection for those folks.
What's the character of the flu that's out there this year? We know it can hit different ages or different groups depending on the strain and characteristics mm-hmm. of any given year's influenza. What's it look like this year?
So this year, well, let's just reinforce something you've just said, Tom. Influenza has the capacity to mutate, to change, and different flu strains dominate in different years. This year, we have a dominance of a more severe strain. We call it the AH3N2 strain. It tends to produce more severe influenza and tends to disproportionately affect people who are older and debilitated. So we're having a pretty severe, not the worst, but pretty severe flu season this year.
If it's If it's bad, you say the dreaded effects. I mean, yeah, okay, so this one is hitting older people more heavily, but I'm reading a terrible news story here from today.com about a young, very healthy young woman, high school senior athlete who died. It was just for 17 years old, sick for just a few days, and died from flu. When it goes that bad, what goes wrong? What takes it from, you know, oh, bring me soup to I'm at death's door?
Influenza is a virus that can affect all of us, even if we're young and healthy. Unfortunately, it carries away children, healthy children, each year. Here's a young adult who got influenza, and then the combination of the virus itself and the fact that her immune system actually responded very briskly to this virus, mm-hmm. that combination caused a very severe illness in that young woman. The recommendations are that all of us older than 6 months of age, that's mm-hmm. everyone listening, should be vaccinated against influenza each and every year.
The immune system's own response helps deepen the severity of the illness? How? What does that mean, Dr. Schaffner?
The inflammatory response, the response of the immune system, can be so overwhelming that it can actually produce an illness that's in addition to the damage caused by the virus itself.
What's the evidence or the presentation of that immune system response? What is it?
What you have to do is measure a number of immune parameters, including some immune modulators called cytokines. And we even call it this over-response a cytokine storm.
I mean, how do I know that that's happening? Is that why I've got my chest is congested, my nose is running, or is it something else? Are there visible signs of that immune response?
It's an overwhelming illness. You feel terrible. You have difficulty breathing. You have high fever, aches and pains all over your body. This is not just the infection that's itself limited to your respiratory tract, your throat and lungs, but your whole body feels very sick and you feel awful.
You know, it hits the body. It hits organizations, too. Dr. Schaffner, please stand by there in Nashville. Denise Stern joins us right now from Fairfax Station in Virginia, president and CEO of Let Mommy Sleep. It's a company that sends out staff to help overnight with newborns. Nice if you can afford it. Her business has been hard hit this year by the flu. As much as 20% of her staff out sick at any one time for the past 3 months. Denise Stern, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
I mean, you clearly don't want to send your staff out. They're going to take care of infants, newborns. They've got to go out healthy if they possibly can. But this has really hit you. When did it start, and what's the toll been?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it started, I would say, right after the holiday times. And the thing that you have to remember about baby nurses and what we do is that no one is healthier than somebody who watches infants and newborns. These are not mere mortals. They have tricks and, you know, things up their sleeve that keep them healthy that the rest of us don't. So for us to be so down in staff is really remarkable.
And even so, with all the care they surely do take, like one out of four or five of your staff laid low.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
What does that mean? I mean, what does it mean for you as a business? Do you just got to run around trying to find people to throw into the breach?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's devastating. I mean, for a couple of reasons. The first is that, exactly, I mean, profits are down. There's no getting around that. You know, that's small business, though, right? It's just putting out different fires Nope. throughout the year. Our fire right now is flu season. But yes, it's a matter trying to maintain staff and then, you know, maintaining also for our families that, you know, yes, this is a safe bastion for you. You know, we are here to help and keep you healthy in addition to, of course, running around and getting staff, like you said.
How do you instruct your caretakers for these newborns to know, to be alert to when they're coming down with the flu?
Well, it's, I mean, look, if you have even a sniffle, you're not working, right? So there's not much instruction. It's we always err on the side of caution, even if we're wrong. And unfortunately, this year, we really haven't been wrong.
Dr. Schaffner, are newborns, you know, we always hear about special immunities they may have from mother's breast milk, or are they protected against flu or vulnerable?
Well, both ends of the age spectrum, the old and the very young, are the most vulnerable. And here's an important point. Women who are pregnant should get vaccinated. Mm-hmm. Not only does that protect them, but they pass some of that protection across the placenta, and so their newborn babies have some protection before we can vaccinate them, because we can only start vaccinating the babies at age 6 months. So if you get the pregnant woman vaccinated, then she will protect that baby when the baby's born.
Interesting. That is good advice, and may help that newborn when it first comes on the scene. Denise Stern, here we are. It's taken a heavy toll on your business. Is it feeling like it's peaking out? Are people coming back, regaining their health now in the ranks of your employees?
I mean, I got to tell you, we're recruiting every single day to fill these holes. We're still seeing so much illness, you know, and trying to patch the holes where we can, for sure.
Well, it's not easy when it hits, and plenty of workplaces and schools and more, as we've heard in this hour, have been hit. It hit a number of staff right here at On Point, and I was right there among them. Denise Stern, President CEO of Let Mommy Sleep, great name. We wish you good luck, Denise. I hope your staff is back and in fine form very soon there for all those little ones out there.
Thank you, sir.
Denise Stern in Fairfax Station, Virginia. Dr. William Schaffner at Vanderbilt in Nashville, Tennessee. Please stand by. There's more we want to learn and explore. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about this tough flu season in full flow right now. What makes for a bad flu season? What's got this one cranked up? And looking at the mysteries of the flu, influenza. You can join us this hour. Are you in the grip of flu, or have you been? Your family, your workplace, your office? Did you get the flu shot and get the flu anyway? And do you see why doctors say get it, even if it's imperfect? Health workers, who, what do you see coming in? Do you see the flu wave that's hitting the country right now? This year, it has been particularly tough on the very young and the older. Here's Zach Moore, an epidemiologist for the state of North Carolina, talking with WRAL Television in Raleigh, saying that the elderly, a particular risk. North Carolina Department of Health Human Services reported that 44 people died from flu-related illness from October 2nd there to February 18th.
This year, we're seeing a lot of our flu deaths in people over 65. We're seeing a lot of outbreaks in nursing homes and long-term care facilities.
But it's not just nursing homes, and it's not just the elderly. Here's Dr. Gadi Korpas telling Austin Television, KTVC, in January, he'd seen double the usual number of documented flu cases in Central Texas. Even very healthy individuals can face serious complications when they get the flu.
We've had healthy people, even those who are military type, muscle build individuals who end up in the hospital with severe pneumonia or respiratory failure, or not even, unfortunately, not making it.
Even those military type muscle built individuals ending up in the hospital. Dr. William Schaffner is with us, professor of preventative medicine, Department of Health Policy at Vanderbilt University's School of Medicine. Dr. John Traynor joins us in just a moment from University of Rochester Medical Center. But a couple of callers first. Deborah in Columbia, South Carolina. Deborah, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate you taking my phone call, and I really enjoy your show.
Thank you. What have you seen?
The real reason why I'm calling is you had mentioned the young lady who just passed away, and that we had the same thing in Columbia 2 weeks ago. It's amazing. The 16-year-old kid was sick 2 days with the flu, and the next thing you know, he died, and nobody knew. We're like, well, what happened, you know? They said the only thing they knew was he had the flu for like 2 days and then passed. And they had his funeral like last week.
Wow, that
and,
is
I'm calling terrible. Today because I'm sick myself. I think I have a cold. I don't believe I have the flu because it seems like a lot of folks around here have it. So,
yeah. I hate to hear that story, Deborah. It's so sad when anybody goes down. But to see someone that young, sort of in the prime of youth, go down is doubly disconcerting. I appreciate your call from Columbia. Dr. Schaffner, help us think about this, because You know, I think most Americans, you think, well, I got the flu. It's a bummer. It may take a couple of 3 days at home, drink fluids, you know, rest. But then you hear a story about someone who just, it's fatal. How can an individual know if they're in the grip of flu, but it's okay, just ride it out, or if they've got a crisis going on?
So, Tom, I rarely use the word flu because it tends to be dismissive. I always talk about influenza.
Same thing, bigger word. Okay.
It sounds more serious, and we need to take influenza seriously. If you're affected, you're obviously going to get really feeling punk. But if you feel absolutely sick, and if you have difficulty breathing, by all means, please call your healthcare provider. But more importantly, so many of us should call our healthcare providers immediately after we become sick because there's treatment available now. And your healthcare provider might write a prescription for an antiviral drug that actually can reduce the duration of the illness and modify it so that you're less likely to get the complications. But you've got to begin it as quickly as possible.
We're talking Tamiflu or something like that here. Tamiflu, is that what you mean?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Tamiflu is the most widely used drug orally in the United States.
How early does it have to be taken for it to have an effect?
It would be best within the first 48 hours, but there are data now to suggest that even if you begin after that, you can get some benefit. So we urge treatment.
I think most people say, oh, I can ride this out. I mean, that's what I did. You know, your first reaction is, oh, it's not so bad. I can ride it out. It's easy to get past 48 hours before you seek help.
That's very, very common. But particularly for people who are older, the very young, if you have underlying heart disease or lung disease, mm-hmm. if you're diabetic, if you have asthma, those people ought to call their providers immediately because they're all more likely to get one of these really serious complications.
If you've got a flu that's heading toward the lethal, what would the evidence or the symptoms of that be?
Again, you're feeling terribly. You have fever. You're becoming dehydrated. You just want to lie in bed. You can barely bring your head up off the pillow. You have aches and pains. You may have difficulty breathing. All of those things combined make it look like really more serious influenza.
We're talking influenza. Mary in Milwaukee. Thank you for calling, Mary. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Well, he just described my symptoms.
Oh, great.
Started for me on February 3rd.
Yeah, Feb 3rd. Okay.
March 1st, and I'm still not feeling a whole lot better.
Almost a month. And what is it? It's been just like he's described. How do you get along for such a long time in that condition?
It's been tough, let me tell you. It's been everything I have just to move. I missed 2 weeks of work. I'm back to work, but unfortunately, I just don't feel very good. I have no energy. I'm lethargic, and I'd rather just be home in bed.
Dr. Schefter, respond to that. That's almost a month. Is that weird? Is it? How long does it take to work out of some of these flus?
I'm afraid it's not all that weird. Prolonged disability is very, very common, and particularly so, once again, among people who are older, who are already not entirely functional, who are frail. What we discover is once you've had influenza and the acute infection leaves, you are left with a disability frequently, and you may not ever come back to your level of function again.
What?
If you were particularly frail to start. This happens particularly with older people and a variety of activities of daily living, Tom. So influenza is a serious infection, both acutely and it has long-term consequences.
What's the best way to speed recovery?
The best way to speed
recovery. I don't mean to
recovery,
rush it, but to maximize recovery.
Sure. Immediately get that antiviral drug. Maintain your fluid intake. Those are the two things that I think are most important. And remember, we're talking about treatment here. Prevention is best. It's late now, and we never say it's too late, but if you haven't been vaccinated, run. Do not walk to your doctor or pharmacist and get the vaccine.
One more, and we'll go to Dr. Trainer here, Mason in Ferndale, Michigan. Mason, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What's your story?
So I'm probably one of the few individuals who don't regularly get sick. I don't want to brag, but I don't remember a time that I have been sick.
Good for
I
you.
I don't get a flu shots regularly.
Well.
Last time I saw a doctor was a while ago when I went to the emergency room for a physical accident at work.
Okay.
I constantly see people getting sick around me. I convene with my mom, who is a nurse, regularly, who is surrounded by sick people.
Yeah.
They'll get sick, but I won't get sick. I'm a college student, and so I get far less sleep than I should. I don't eat as right as I should. I only work out about twice a week.
Okay, you're a natural Superman, Mason. Where are you going with this?
I'm just calling saying I do see people getting sick all the time, and I do feel for people like my roommate. He's been sick for the third time this year, and I'm just curious. Am I just a Terminator who doesn't get sick anymore, or am I just sailing towards a huge storm?
Yeah, right. Lucky or headed for the big one, Dr. Schaffner? Are some people just blessed with higher levels of immunity somehow?
In general, that's true. Mason is young and strong, so his immune system is able to fight off the influenza. But there are studies to show if we were to take some blood specimens from Mason before and after the influenza season, we could see evidence that he likely had influenza infection but fought it off. But he was able to spread it to others.
Oh, great.
And nobody wants to be a dreaded spreader. The only way to prevent that is to get vaccinated.
Don't be a dreaded spreader, Mason. Get your flu shot. Dr. William Schaffner, please stand by there in Nashville. Dr. John Trainer joins us right now from Rochester, New York. He's chief of infectious diseases at the University of Rochester Medical Center. His research focuses on the control of influenza with vaccines and antivirals. Dr. John Trainer, thank you very much for being with us today.
Yeah, it's great to be here, Tom, and hi to Bill as well.
Great to have you both. Size up this year's influenza season. Where is it in the spectrum of, you know, good, bad, ugly?
Well, I think all influenza seasons are bad. The impact so far, and it's still early, but from what is available so far, looks like this is going to be a pretty typical year when we have that H3N2 virus as the dominant virus causing the epidemic.
H3N2. And so when they put that swab up my nose, that's what they're looking for? What kind of flu would it be?
Yeah, so influenza comes in, well, the kind that really causes serious disease comes in two flavors, B and A.
Okay.
And then the A's get divided into a whole bunch of subtypes, and the ones that cause disease in humans right now are the H1N1 and the H3N2. And in years when the AH3N2 is the one that's out there causing most of the disease, those are typically, not always, but usually the years when we see the biggest impact in terms of hospitalizations and deaths. Obviously, H1 can be bad, too. We had that big epidemic or pandemic back in 2009. But the more typical thing is for the H3N2 viruses to be associated with the biggest overall impact.
And that's what we've got this year. Geographically, what's it look like? Can you sort of describe a map of the country and where it's worse or better, Dr. Trainer?
Yeah, so if you had a map of the country and you painted a big stripe down the northeast and into the south and southwest, you would be covering the area where right now the biggest sort of activity is for flu, with much less going on in the northeast and along the west coast. And I'm not really sure why that is. It might just be happenstance or weather. I don't think anybody really knows. But minute variations geographically in flu activity are pretty common during the course of the season.
Is there a standard calendar for when it peaks, Dr. Trainer, in the course of a calendar year?
Now, I wish if people really knew that, that would be great. You know, one of the leading ideas is that children play a major role in transmission of flu, and so the sort of traditional flu season starts when kids go back to school after the winter holidays. So the most typical thing you see would be a real uptick in disease in January and a peak sometime in February or early March. And we're following that kind of roadmap pretty closely this year. But if you look over the years, it's really hard to know. Sometimes the peak happens in December. Sometimes you don't get your peak until late March or April. So there's, you know, no really consistent pattern, except that in the Northern Hemisphere, influenza is seasonal and does occur during the winter months.
Dr. Schaffner, what about transmission? How exactly does it happen?
Well, as John said, children are the great disseminators. This is a respiratory virus, and so if you have influenza and you breathe out, what you breathe out will have minute microscopic viral particles in it, the influenza virus. And if someone else is within 3 feet of you, your breathing zone, and they breathe that virus in, that can then infect them. And influenza is a highly infectious virus. And children who get around a lot are not the most hygienic and give lots of people hugs and kisses and get close to them are the great spreaders of influenza amongst themselves and to mom and dad, Aunt Susie, and to their grandparents.
Let's go to Jeff in Madison, Wisconsin. Jeff, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. The woman from Milwaukee who is back in the office and not feeling well reminded me of a bit of research reported by John Barry in his great book, The Great Influenza, which was about the flu pandemic of 1918-19. And interestingly enough, the largest cohort killed by that pandemic was the 18 to 35-year-olds, apparently because their strong immune systems overreacted to the virus and essentially caused their death. But the thing I remember,
including a lot of young American soldiers coming home from World War I who were laid low by the flu.
Absolutely. And the thing I remember from that book and have told friends ever since and family, that Johns Hopkins did a lot of research afterwards with survivors and found the two things that helped people to survive that more than anything, granted medicine was young at the time, but more than anything was A, wash your hands a lot, we know that, but B was staying in bed beyond that point at which we all have the inclination to say, I really got to get up and get back to work. Staying in bed till you're absolutely feeling normal, and those who did that tended to survive, and those who couldn't resist that, you know, the inbox didn't. So
the record of that Spanish influenza, 50 to 100 million dead, that 3 to 5% of the world's population, that's pretty incredible. Dr. Schaffner, what about that advice? Stay in bed beyond the moment that you really don't want to anymore.
Well, actually, I think today most of us would say start moving, because the longer you are horizontal, the weaker you will become. You do recover better if, within reason, you can sit up at the edge of the bed, do a little bit of exercise, walk around your room, and get yourself vertical again.
Okay. You don't have to go full triathlete, but get in motion at least at some point.
Yes.
Dr. Trainer, where does this stuff hide out in the summer when we're not all sneezing and hacking and coughing and fluing?
That's always been one of the great mysteries of influenza. But what we do know is that when we're in the summertime and not having flu, in the southern hemisphere where it's their winter, they do have flu. So there's always some flu going on somewhere in the world, and it appears to be transmitted back and forth between the hemispheres as the seasons oscillate back and forth. There have always been lots of other theories, including possibly that people might latently be infected and harbor it without having any symptoms for months and months and months and then reactivate, or theories that perhaps it came to Earth and comets, all sorts of theories. But I think what's really happening is just that these viruses are constantly circulating somewhere and then being transmitted back and forth between continents and the hemispheres.
I'm pretty sure that mine came to Earth in a particularly ugly comet. I don't know what universe it came from, but somewhere dark and far away. I wish I'd never met it. Dr. John Trainer, please stand by there in Rochester, New York. Dr. William Schaffner in Nashville, Tennessee. We're talking about influenza, the flu. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are talking this hour about this tough flu season in full flow right now. Maybe it's come to you or to people near you. We're going to turn in a moment to look at a rise in colorectal cancer among the young. It's associated with older victims very often, but it's headed up among the young. We'll look at what's going on there and why. But first, we're on the flu. A lot of people have it. It has not been the worst, but it has not been the best year for flu. Dr. John Traynor is with us from the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. William Schaffner is here from Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. And Dr. Schaffner and Traynor, we've got a lot of people writing in here about how they avoid it. I mean, Sheila says, we've never gotten the flu shot. We use high levels of vitamin D, probiotics, vitamin C, green superfoods. We start in August for winter. So they're just eating right to avoid the flu. Charles writes to us. He says, prevention is best. I am 90 and never get the flu. I take 3,000 IU of vitamin D every day of the year. Saved lives, saved money. What about lifestyle or preventative nutrition, Dr. Schaffner?
Well, God bless them. And of course, we want to stay as healthy as possible. But there are no data to suggest in a rigorous study that the kinds of things that have been suggested really do prevent influenza. Influenza is a viral infection, and it can get you even if you've eaten only the best sandwiches.
Bummer, bummer. Sam in Canton, Ohio. Sam, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I have a couple of issues I would like your panel to address. Now, first of all, I'm 62 years old. My wife is several years younger than I.
Okay.
And we rarely get sick. But mid-February last month, my wife came down with a bug, and she ran a fever for 5 days. It peaked at 102.7. Mm-hmm. Now, halfway through her ordeal, I got thrown under the bus, but I did not get a fever. But the one symptom that we did share in common was that we just coughed continually for 2 weeks. So my question is, what, is there a difference between a cold and influenza? And the second question I have, I spoke to coworkers and about flu shots.
Yeah.
And the majority of the people I spoke to said they got sick on the flu shot and they would never get it again. I've never had one. And I was just wondering, is it safe to not get a flu shot, or do you get sick when you get a flu shot? And I'll take the comments off the air.
Sam, we've got the panel for you right here. Let's look at both of those. First of all, Dr. Traynor, what's the difference, Sam says, between a cold and the flu? Is there one?
Well, I think this is, brings up a lot of really interesting points, but one of which is that not everything that causes a fever or respiratory symptoms that happens in the winter is necessarily influenza. So there are other viruses that can also cause similar illnesses, and we're learning that that they also circulate and are responsible for some proportion of the disease. And in this particular case, I would suspect that possibly these guys actually had respiratory syncytial virus, which is a different virus than flu, but which can cause particularly this wheezing, prolonged cough kind of thing without a fever, might be a little bit more typical of respiratory syncytial virus. But, you know, the other thing is people behave differently, and there are certainly even genetic differences in the way the innate immune system responds by producing all those cytokines that could actually impact the level of symptoms different people get when they're infected with any virus, influenza included, and part of an incredibly complicated mix of underlying health, the degree of immunity, mm-hmm. genetic differences and cytokine responses, and all of these things that are a mixture that determines what the outcome's going to be.
It's funny. You go for a few years without the flu, and you start to feel like you're immune, and then, boom, it can come around and grab you. Dr. Schaffner, what about, and many people are writing this online as well, this question about can you get sick from the flu shot?
There's a great myth out there that you can get flu from the flu vaccine. That cannot happen. Of course, some people get a little bit of soreness at the injection site, a little redness and tenderness, mm-hmm. and that can last a few days. The studies would indicate that about 1%, maybe 1.5% of people may get a degree of fever for a day. But those are just local reactions to the inoculation. You don't get sick with the virus. You know, we vaccinate actually at the onset and during the winter respiratory virus season. Mm-hmm. So often what happens is coincidence. You get your influenza vaccine on Monday, and on Friday, you come down with a cold or another one of those respiratory viruses, as John has just said, and you make a false link between the two. You can't get flu from the flu vaccine.
It's good to know. A little reaction maybe, but not the flu. Cameron in Meriden, Connecticut. Cameron, you're on the air. Thanks for calling. What's your story?
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
So I'm a personal trainer, and me and my coworkers have been dealing with all of our clients getting the flu over the winter. The only people who didn't get the flu were all the personal trainers. So I want to comment on saying that we all preach good health and eating habits, and hopefully that's the main reason we didn't get it. And also I have a question, is are we totally immune from it, or is there a ticking time bomb where we might get it eventually?
I love it. Dr. Trainer, speaking of trainers, all the personal trainers with Cameron there feels superhuman and immune right now, but he's worried. Can it come around and grab them as well?
Sure. Well, one thing I would say, and I think Bill had pointed this out before, is they may be feeling fine, but they're probably the ones who transmitted the flu to all of their clients. So, you know, you do have to, I'm being facetious, obviously, but you do have to realize that vaccines not only are important in preventing disease in the person who gets the vaccine, but they also play an important potential role in preventing spread. And so when we vaccinate healthy people, we're doing something to prevent them from spreading the virus to people who aren't so healthy and might have consequences from being infected. So don't just think of flu vaccines as a measure that prevents the person from becoming ill. It's also an important measure that tries to prevent the transmission of the virus to more susceptible or compromised individuals who might have bad outcomes. Now, for any individual, you know, it's kind of a roll of the dice. There are all of these factors in play that determine what the outcome of your disease is going to be, and maybe the first 20 times you roll the good number, and then the 20th time it comes up bad. I don't think you can rely on your history of not having been sick before to really predict that you'll never get sick in the future.
Dr. Schaffner, what about health workers? I mean, you know, everybody comes flocking into the health centers. They must be really under the gun for flu, or do they have build up some kind of immunity?
Well, we are under the gun. Not only do we wish to remain healthy during influenza season so we can provide good care, but of course, also, Tom, we don't want to spread flu to our patients.
Right.
So it's both a professional and an ethical obligation for all healthcare workers to be vaccinated against influenza each and every year. And indeed, many hospitals now have made it mandatory. It's part of our life.
Well, here we are, peak of the season. We're told, let's hope that it's not a high, long plateau. Everybody's ready to move past this. We'll be looking for that. Really interesting to have the two of you with us here to dive into what's going on with influenza this year and in general. Dr. William Schaffner at the Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. It's always great to have you here, Bill. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
And Dr. John Trainer in Rochester, New York at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Trainer, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
In a moment, we will look at new research showing a rise in colorectal cancer in young adults in their 20s and 30s. This is On Point. A study published yesterday by the American Cancer Society shows a significant increase in colorectal cancer among Generation X and millennials. The authors say people born in 1990 have double the risk of colon cancer and quadruple the risk of rectal cancer compared to the risk of someone born in 1950, the risk they would have faced at a similar age. Joining me now is Dr. John Marshall, director at the Roush Center for the Cure of Gastrointestinal Cancers at Georgetown University. Dr. John Marshall, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks very much for having me.
We associate colorectal cancers with older victims, I guess.
Every textbook I ever read says that it's supposed to be in people over the age of 50, more common 60, 70, 80. And in fact, that's why we do screening when we do, is pick that up. But We have seen, as you've said, this alarming trend over the last 10-plus years of very young people showing up with a disease that's supposed to be in the older population.
Why might we see it in younger people now when we did not, apparently, a generation or more earlier?
Boy, that's the million-dollar question that everybody wants to know. There's a lot of speculation. One theory is that, you know, we have an increased obesity and less exercise, all of that. But in fact, most of the patients that we have that are young are not those people. They are what I call marathon running, cardboard eating people. They never really did anything wrong in their lives. And so an alternative theory is that, in fact, we've somehow altered what we call our microbiome. Now, our listeners know, I think, what that means. It's the bacteria that's on us and in us.
Yeah.
And each one of us has this beautiful coral reef of bacteria in our colons.
Yeah.
And we're to maintain that. And we really haven't been studying what we've been doing to our coral reef, if you will, with changes in antibiotic usage, washing our hands so much, not going out and playing with other kids. And so in some way, we may have sterilized or altered our microbiome such that we've shifted it towards a more carcinogenic bacteria in our colon. So we're now looking at this to try and figure it out, and we're hoping that, in fact, the science that we'll discover, the answers that we will discover, will teach us more and more about who should be screened, who shouldn't be screened, not only for the young folks, but for everybody.
Boy, it's kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't. You don't want to get the flu, so you wash your hands, then you're too clean, and you end up susceptible here. If that were the case, is there a rise among older Americans as well? Or?
Actually, the counter is true. So we are seeing in the over 50 age set and a decline, an improvement in outcomes, so less colon cancer and lower mortality. And we're, of course, patting ourselves on the back a bit because we may be seeing an improvement there because of screening, the actual colonoscopy and testing.
Yep.
We have an increased compliance with that in the United States, and so we are seeing a fall there. So that's our only explanation for the improvement on that end, but we're trading it for this really disturbing trend of very young people in the prime of their lives getting a diagnosis that no one was expecting.
Americans 50-plus are told to go in for a colonoscopy, for that screening, but younger Americans are not. So how would a younger person even have any idea if they were at risk or had actually developed a colorectal cancer?
And we have to remember this. I mean, it's a really good question, but we have to remember that screening every healthy person for cancer, ideally, this is a test that is non-invasive, inexpensive, easy to give. Well, colonoscopies are really none of those things. They're very good tests, but they're not cheap. They are, of course, invasive.
Yeah.
We do have stool testing, which meets this criteria, but we need to understand better who should be tested before we start saying every 20-year-old or 30-year-old needs to have some screening for colon cancer. So I'm hopeful that we will learn quickly enough so that we can identify those at risk and intervene.
But right now, you don't have an easy way of doing that. So when this shows up, you know, people are listening right now, perhaps in their 20s and 30s, and want some kind of guidance on how to be alert, aware, attuned.
Absolutely. So the number one sort of presenting symptom is sort of altered bowel habits or some bleeding. And of course, if you're in your 20s or 30s, even if you go to see your primary care doc or an emergency room, for example, that's colon cancer is low on the list
mm-hmm.
of problems that this might be.
They won't think that's
things.
Your profile.
Right. So we are really sending this message out to those frontline healthcare providers to make sure they're aware of this trend so that when someone comes in with one of these symptoms that the appropriate testing is done. Because what we are seeing is that when it's not recognized, that cancers are, of course, more advanced by the time they are picked up. So we want a good sensitivity trigger here, not just on the consumer side, the patient side, but also on the healthcare delivery side. The other barrier, of course, is our payers, our insurance companies don't always cover this kind of procedure without some sort of sparking symptoms. So a 30-year-old just can't walk in saying, I'm nervous that I might have colon cancer, yeah, and have their colonoscopy. They have to have some symptoms before a payer, an insurance company, would provide that support.
From your research, how common is colorectal cancer now among the young compared to 50, 60 plus?
Well, still, it's one of the most common cancers overall. About 150,000 patients will be diagnosed this year in the United States. So as an individual, your risk is not that great, but it's certainly a common cancer. And while it was extremely rare in the young patient population previously, over the last couple of decades, we're seeing a doubling and tripling of that incidence. That doesn't mean there are lots of patients or lots of people in that age group who will get colon cancer, but it does mean that, for example, in my clinic here at Georgetown University, mm-hmm, a high proportion of my patients are now under the age of 50.
Dr. Marshall, for your own family, let's say, your own kids, if you were thinking about their microbiome and wanting to keep it strong and healthy, what would you recommend in terms of lifestyle?
Half as a joke is I would take them to the mall and have them lick the door.
Oh, my God.
But, you know, when I was a kid, and I'm an old guy now, I was told to go out and play in the backyard and make a mud pie and actually then eat it. Roll in the dirt a little bit. And So I do think we have maybe swung too far. Now, I'm not encouraging that licking the door at the mall. I'm just teasing on that one. But I do think as we learn the impact of altering our flora, our bacteria, on not only cancer, we think this may have a role in allergy and other medical issues.
Live a little. Get out there.
Responses, maturity, all of these things factor into this. So it's science that we hope will move quickly so that we can give you a really good answer to the question.
Let's hope so. Dr. John Marshall at Georgetown University, thank you so much for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.